Okay, I guess I'll get started. So today I wanted to move on from vanilla Markov chain Monte Carlo Metropolis Hastings to affine invariant samplers. Just to like re-traumatize you, here's the MZMC algorithm that we you now know and love, I hope, or at least have a like a deep and personal frustration and annoyance with. This time, oh yeah, right, this time in Julia. And so, okay, one thing that I kind of like, I showed you, I kind of started with the context where I use Markov chain Monte Carlo, which is you're doing inference. But really, like the MCMC algorithm is a pretty general thing because it gets passed in a log probability function. It doesn't know that you're doing, you know, inference in a forward modeling problem and trying to measure things about the universe. But you know, if we do pass in, like if we've set up our problem, if we've set up a probability function to do that, then you know, we can use results from MCMC to sample things in this case, the axis labels are really small, but these are the slopes and intercepts that you've come to know and love, let's say. And yeah, I guess one thing I wanted to make a demo this morning because I think one thing that there were a couple of things that kind of weren't they weren't really obvious in the lab, which was sort of like why do MCMC? Why do we need MCMC when it seemed like the results we were getting from just running a linear optimizer were just fine. And there are kind of two reasons, or like another thing many people pointed out was like, why can't we just throw a grid over this space and evaluate the likelihood at each point and then just, you know, plot it up? Like, why do we have to go to all this effort of sampling it? So as far as why not throw a grid on, in two dimensions it's fine, but it's like really common to see 10 dimensions, 15 dimensions, like no problem. You know, people who are doing like galaxy, like kind of my baryon acoustic oscillations in galaxy surveys, they'll often have like six or eight nuisance parameters that just say like sort of how galaxies form in dark matter halos. So then throwing, pardon?
Why is that a nuisance parameter?
Because it doesn't tell you about cosmology, but it's like a detail of the model. There's no like real, it's kind of a subjective call of what's a nuisance parameter. But you know, often it's sort of some like, if it's some kind of technical detail of how you implemented it, then it's usually kind of considered a nuisance parameter. And if it's something that is in like the headline of your paper, then it's not a nuisance. So yeah, so basically high dimensional problems are pretty common in practice. And you can't really throw a grid over 10 dimensions because it's just too many sample points. And it's also kind of hard to understand what's going on in that sort of space as well. And then the reason why we can't just use, you know, these, take that error ellipse. I wanted to make a demo where I had a likelihood in mind. Actually, maybe I'll make you do this for your homework. This is a good homework, actually. So what I was thinking was, I wanted to cook up a scenario where, thank you, where the space was curved. So I was thinking, like, because one of the situations you see a lot is there's some sort of like where the likelihood is sort of like a banana shaped or kind of smiley faced. And I know that's if that's your that's not a good banana. Anyway, it says smiley face. Likelihood surface, like these are the contours. So then if you did this kind of linear approach, it's going to give you, so I sort of drew it with this being the peak. It'll give you something that's like where it says, oh, the contour is like that. Know, so then if you say, oh, that's my one sigma, here's two sigma, there's three sigma, just doesn't like, you know, it captures near the peak the local behavior, but it doesn't really extrapolate out to what's happening in the rest of the space. So yeah, whereas like MCMC would give you this full sampling of the space. So actually maybe, yeah, actually that's a good homework problem. You can see that I'm like, I haven't thought that far ahead about what to get you to do. All right, I'm gonna go back to slides now. Thanks, Craig. Okay, and then in the labs you saw that, you know, Metropolis Hastings suffers this problem that you have to do the tuning parameters, right? If your steps are too big, then you get a small acceptance ratio and it just takes a long time to get around the space. If you do the small steps, then it also takes you a long time to get around the space. And you saw kind of firsthand that, like, you know, you basically have to come up with these tuning parameters, these like step sizes. And, you know, when I showed you that before, you were like, oh, it's three parameters, that's not much to set. Well, you only had to do two in the lab and it was a pain, right? So you can see that if you had to set like six in a three-dimensional problem or 10 in a four-dimensional problem, you'd start to question your life decisions. Okay, so what's the solution? One brand, oh yeah, and then, you know, as you go to higher dimensional problems, your life gets more difficult and you question your life decisions. And you think, why? I want to have scientific awesomeness without pain. So one branch of solutions to this problem is ensemble samplers with affine invariants. And for some reason, because I didn't see Dan Forman-Mackie give this talk in person, he has glorious mustaches on everybody. It's some sort of like millennial in-joke sort of thing, I think. But yes, so, pardon?
What is the joke?
Well, I don't know. It's fun. I think it's just funny to draw mustaches on people.
It looks like Marco.
Is that photoshopped?
It's some sort of, he gave a link on one of the slides. It was like there's some like website that puts mustaches on people. It's, again, you know, I'm too old to understand what's going on there.
Isn't because of the Markov mustache that we were
talking
about today, maybe?
Maybe Markov's in a tribute to Markov's glorious mustache. That could be. That's a feasible possibility. I don't know. I've never heard anybody actually talk about Andrei Markov before, oddly enough, in all of my MCMC experiences. So I don't know how widely it is known that he has a mustache worthy of glorying. Anyway, so yeah, this. So one way around this is to do these ensemble samplers, which gives you affine invariants. And at least in astronomy, this was really popularized by this software package called MC. And, you know, so the title of the paper is something like MC, the MCMC hammer, because we were like, this is a tool that you can just use for bashing problems. So it's a hammer looking for nails, and it's funny. On the paper, and I think my primary contribution was naming it. It turns out it's a clever written name, but a terrible spoken name, because it just sounds like the letters MC, which is like why it's funny written, but it's annoying to use in spoken use because you can't distinguish it from MCMC because it's just MC. Anyway, and so partly this was, I think this kind of, had a lot of impact because it was like delivering a bunch of things that people were looking for in practice, and it kind of it really took off. So what does it do? So we saw in plain old MCMC, we're kind of simulating moving this single particle around the space, right? I'll use the word like particle and walker and point and state space interchangeably. So in normal Metropolis Hastings, we're simulating moving a single particle around this space. In ensemble samplers, you think about moving a bunch of particles around at once. And instead of sampling just from the state of the single particle, you sample based on the state of the whole ensemble. So it's still Markov. You're still making a decision about where to go next based on your current state. But the state is, instead of the position of a single particle, it's the state, the position of a bunch of particles. And the way you do the sampling is for each point, you choose another point to be your helper. And then you say, I'm going to sample along the line connecting those two points. The proposal, like the proposal distribution, is at least the one, you know, the kind of stock version advocated in this paper is this one, where it's sort of it's proportional to it, like it goes between a half and a factor of two of the distance between them. And it has that shape just so it's kind of reversible, so it's like invertible. And then the acceptance rule is pretty similar to Metropolis Hastings. This is this z value is like that, basically that function. And it depends on the dimensionality of the problem. I'm not going to make you implement this one in the labs because kind of it's a little bit more involved. And so it's a little odd, like the number of, I don't entirely understand why, like I don't have a gut feeling for why that is, why it drops off, like why you exponentiate that probability with the number of parameters. But it, you know, he.
Sorry,
I think it kind of works.
What is z exactly?
Z is that distribution. So this it would end up being a factor between a half and two. No, sorry. No, I've got it wrong.
Okay.
No, it's the height of that probability function.
What?
I should have said. So it's like, how do they write it? They write it as, the authors of this are statisticians, so they are kind of more proper about notation. So they say that the z's are drawn from a distribution g of z that is, proportional to 1 over square root z or z in square brackets a half 2 and then 0 otherwise. So it's just, it's got to label the axes, right? So that is like the z value, and this would be 0. It drops off like that. Make sense? And it's just it's just proportional because it's a probability function. So you just have to have some normalizing factor that you don't really care about, or maybe. It's not super important to understanding the behavior of algorithms. So.
And where does z start? You put the distribution there. Where is it starting? In the middle of the two points, the helper and the point that you.
Oh yeah, like where is one? One is the. Yeah, is staying where you were. yeah, one would be staying where you were, and a half would be stepping toward the helper, and two would be stepping away from the helper. Yeah.
How do you choose the helper?
Oh, just randomly.
Oh.
Yeah, so you just randomly choose one of the other points.
So it's more likely to get closer to a random helper than to move away from the random helper.
On average, it's equal because the it's just like it's split evenly, so that it's as likely to move towards in a way.
Would it change the results if you did like a uniform distribution?
Yes, because then like if you made it uniform across all that, then on average you'd be more likely to step away.
Oh, okay. What if you made it like a little shorter thing? It was a uniform distribution, but it's got the same likelihood of stepping away as...
Oh yeah, if you did it from a half to one and a half or something like that, and you made it uniform, that would probably work equally well. This is nice because you can, I'll show you an example in a second, but if they're all very close together, then they can sort of expand out to the right size in a kind of logarithmic number of steps. Which I guess is still true if you can have a factor of one and a half. Factor of two makes it pretty quick to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. It's a parameter that you can set in the code, this two, but yeah, two works pretty well usually. One of the nice things is that you don't really have to work very hard to initialize it, because you tend to get this behavior where, especially if you're, well, so here you're far from, these are the probability contours, and they keep going. So here you're very far on the tails of the distribution. So the difference from one end to the other in probability is quite high. They pretty quickly discover that jumps in that direction are favorable and jumps in that direction are disfavorable. So as you go step by step, you'll see some of them stay put. So I think in that step, this one stays put because it had no choice but to draw one of these as its helper. And then it's the only options available to it were to jump in that direction. And all of those jumps are disfavorable. So you see that kind of each step, some of them stay put, but in general they tend to move. And they're starting to scatter a little bit, you can see. Especially because along this direction, there's no like gradient in the probability. So they're kind of equally, if you propose stepping in that direction, kind of even chances of whether it's accepted or not. There's sort of nothing stopping it from expanding in that direction. And then there's sort of a general push in the direction toward the peak of the gradient. And I don't know, they're kind of fun to watch. Like it looks like a little amoeba or something. You know, they sort of climb, and then one of them finds a few of them find the good place, and then they sort of eventually make their way over there. Yeah, so it's pretty cool. I'll just step back through it again, and we can replay it in a step by step. So it's kind of fun, right? Start them in this little ball, and then pretty quickly like find the peak, and then start kind of just exploring it. So it's kind of neat that the way, by having this ensemble, they can kind of between themselves sort of figure out where the good place is.
What's happening here?
Yeah, so there, I mean, at each step, each one of them is choosing another sample and then sampling along the line between them. So every single step go through each of those points and say...
Did you put those points in there?
Yeah, so I started them out in the bottom corner there.
Okay.
Yeah. And then just ran this algorithm forward where at each step, each of the points is choosing another one to sample from and sampling along the lines connecting them, and then either moving or staying put.
What's the reason for putting them in a clump rather than just saying, like, okay, we have this range, pick a random spot?
Yeah, that works equally well. You can also just, yeah, spread them kind of evenly.
What are px and px prime in this context?
So that's the same as in Metropolis Hastings. It's the relative probabilities of the proposed jump versus where you started. So imagine you're this point and this one was selected as your helper. Then your choices are that you will choose some sample, like some proposed position along this line to jump to, and then compare the probability here to the probability from that proposed place.
The probability is Gaussian centered at one of these?
The probability is this probability terrain that you're trying to sample, like the log prob that was passed in. Yeah, that's right. Just like in the MCMC setting, like the log probability function would get passed in.
Does MC work better than Metropolis Hastings because it's less likely to get stuck in a local minimum? Is that not always?
The local minimum situation is kind of the same.
Oh, really?
It's maybe a little better, but it's still not that great for distributions that have multi-modes.
If you started with all the things kind of scattered.
Yeah, that's right. If you started them all over, then you'd be more likely to hit like the basin of the actual peak. Other than that factor, it's kind of has the same pitfalls, multimodal distributions. Later, there's another algorithm I'm going to talk about that doesn't have that as well.
Dustin, can I ask a question?
Yeah, please.
Okay. So I'm not sure if I understood that correctly. That's why I'm asking. So would that be more beneficial or more efficient if we spread all the initial positions all over the entire parameter space? I mean, in that case, would it be the case that it finds the true answer or the maximum likelihood faster than if we put the initial positions as a clump, what you did? I mean, because I was thinking the benefit of this method relative to the Metropolis Hastings is that because we have a bunch of points and one of the walkers could be on the other side of parameter space, and this walker looks at that one, based on that, they can find the true place faster than if it's only a single walker and it wants to expand the entire parameter space, which takes super long. Is that true?
Yeah, that's a good comment. I think that's probably true, that if you spread them all over the space, that you have a better chance of finding, like, randomly hitting a good place in the terrain. This is sort of like your question.
That's just the equilibration at the beginning, right? Which is
Right, like, you know, again, this is, yeah, like, yeah, it's kind of like the burn-in phase of, like, getting from your starting point into an equilibrium state. Takes a while. But, yeah, I mean, I guess one of the things I said about Metropolis Hastings is a way to avoid the local minimum problem is to restart a few times and ensure that you converge to the same solution. And I guess sprinkling walkers around is sort of equivalent to that.
Mm-hmm. So one more quick question is that, so for example, if we are doing some sort of parameter estimation or detectability so that we have the true model, and I mean, both of the signal and the data are based on the true model, then we know where to start basically, because we have kind of a prior knowledge that where is, in which region the likelihood would be maximum. But if we have a new detection that we want to do some sort of data analysis, then we don't know where to start, right? And if we start from a wrong position in parameter space, it might take very long for to get the convergence. Is that also correct? Or at least we would have a very, very long burn, what do you call it? Burn-in?
Burn-in.
Section? Yeah, the burn-in period or burn-in section. Is that also correct?
Yeah, I mean, usually you have some notion of where, of, you know, some reasonable region of parameter space where you want to start. And depending on it depends a little bit on what the probability space looks like, or what the terrain looks like. You know, in this case, we happen to have seen that it's basically just one peak, and it's pretty simple. It doesn't really matter where you start. If you're in a really complicated parameter space and you don't know what it looks like and you don't know what the parameters, like, you know, if there might be many peaks around that you don't know about, then it's, life is difficult. I'll talk about, in the nested samplers I'll talk about next, they have a much better kind of way of dealing with those sorts of situations.
Thank you, Raymond.
But yeah, basically, if you're stepping into an unknown, then there's not too much that's magically available to help you out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Let me just. Oh, sure. I just wanted to. So after if I play through this again. Another thing I plotted was I plotted the same points, except I also plotted in red. I think you can see that. You can see that. I hope. Points that were proposed but rejected. Right? So so in this case, yeah, like some of these ones would have chosen a partner on this side and sampled in that direction and proposed to move here, but all of those ones got rejected because they were stepping downhill. And you can, so that sort of shows you how it, you have this, you're not doing a random walk, it's like a biased random walk sort of thing. So it just sort of does what you would sort of expect, like you see the red points sort of on the bottom left in general until it, whoops, oh yeah, I only showed part of it.
You said points that got rejected are red?
Yeah.
In the distribution, the new point doesn't get accepted. It just gives you a distribution, and you find the points on that distribution. So what exactly gets rejected?
Mm. Right. Mm. I should have gone through that a little bit more clearly. Yeah. So. No, I'm going to move this one up front. I'll just do it down here, actually. So at each step in the distribution, you know, you have a bunch of walkers. And when moving this one, you randomly choose one of the others to be your helper. And then draw this random number, draw a random z from that distribution. And that distribution is, you know, shaped like this. But so if you make a random draw from it, you might choose, you know, here. Oops, here on the point, or you might choose here. But you know, for each walker, you just draw a single one. And that's your proposal for where to step this time. So, you know, you would draw, say you draw here, then that's the proposed point.
Do you choose that? So you choose that point, assuming this probability?
Yeah.
Then you still, again, use this probability when you want to see if you want to reject or.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, right, after making this proposed point, you compute the probability there and then apply that acceptance formula, you know, equation.
Yeah.
Has the z in it.
And then if this point doesn't get accepted, you...
Right, you just say where you were.
Yeah, and then you mark that as a red dot, or...?
In that case, this one would get marked as a red dot. Mm-hmm. So you were offered to move there, but you decided to stay here instead.
And then that point is contributing to the rejected point is also contributing to the next...
The rejected point is just gone. But I just plotted it to show, like, that it was offered these, it was offered these choices, or one of them was offered these choices, and they were rejected.
So I see how having many, many walkers that, like, sort of know about each other could be helpful. But why is it the thing that we strive for this to be, like, affine?
The affine invariance of it, is kind of like an emergent property of this sampling algorithm where they're sampling amongst themselves. If you took this parameter space and rescaled it in such a way that it was like even more covariant or whatever, then this algorithm would draw exactly the same samples. Right? Or if you like rescaled it so that this was a nice spherical isotropic space, it would still draw the same samples. It doesn't care. Whereas in like Metropolis Hastings, you saw that a covariant space was a pain.
This
sampler, like, sampling from the ensemble, what it gives you is affine invariance. It has the property that samples are affine invariant. Because basically, if you took this space and just rescaled it, like applied a transformation matrix before it, like, so if we, took our M and B parameters, and instead of inferring those, we applied a transformation, an affine transformation matrix to them first. We could sample in that space instead. Like, we could, it's sort of like applying a preconditioner or something to matrix spaces. So for Metropolis Hastings, that would totally change how the sampling behaved. And for this sampler, it doesn't change it at all, but how the sampler behaves. Because it's sampling from amongst an ensemble, it's sort of adaptive to the shape of the points in that ensemble. So I think of it as, like, in Metropolis Hastings, you're always sort of sampling from an ellipse that's the same shape. Whereas this one, you sample from it's sort of like you're sampling from an ellipse that's adapting to the distribution of the walkers. I don't know if that helps at all.
Yeah, I intuitively don't see why if you transform this space, you have a bunch of points, but there you have also, let's say, two points. You're choosing from a distribution there. Here also you choose one point from the ensemble, another point as the helper, so that would be two points.
Mm.
Metropolis Hastings, you have two points as well, one point.
I guess in Metropolis Hastings, the difference is that you...
you don't have a helper.
Yeah, so exactly. So you just have the proposal distribution.
Yeah.
And that proposal distribution has to be multidimensional. Mm-hmm. You have to have a jump size for each of the dimensions you're jumping in, and then covariances between them. So in that sense, that those jump sizes, if you rescaled the space, you would also have to change those jump sizes.
Oh. Oh, right.
You know.
Jump sizes.
Here there sort of isn't a jump size. There's like no parameters you can change.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's a little it's a little unintuitive, I guess, why it works.
Metropolis Hastings is better than MC or
it's mostly just better. It is slower to, the burn-in is slower because you have to move, well, the burn-in can be slower because you have to move all of these points. You know, they, it's not just like one of them can find the peak, it's like they all sort of have to collectively, kind of like, you know, herding cats, but sure.
Is this equivalent to having multiple walkers in Metro? I'm not saying they're equivalent, I'm just saying if you have multiple walkers in Metropolis Hastings, let's say as many as you have, the, as many of the points that you have here, would that mean that Metropolis Hastings would also be as slow as it is potentially?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure. I guess probably. You would need a good proposal distribution on that, like in Metropolis, like, you know, Metropolis Hastings just depends all about the proposal distribution. So if you had a good proposal distribution, it would probably be faster. But if you have a poor one, then gain. Yeah, so, okay. All right, so one, yeah, so those are kind of the two big advantages that this has, and like the reason it really took off, at least in astronomy, is one, no parameters to set for jump sizes, and two, it turns out that if you randomly split the points into two groups, then if you hold group one, if you make all the ones in group one be the helpers for the ones in group two, then you can move group two in parallel. So you can run it on multiple cores of a computer at once. And then they switch roles. So it's like group one stays still while group two samples. You're gonna, you know, stay still, you're the helpers, group two samples in parallel. And then they switch roles, group two stays still in their new positions to be the helpers, and group one samples from those in parallel. So it lets you run on a, you have a computer with, you know, 40 cores like symmetry, you can run 40 walkers in the same amount of time you can run a single Metropolis Hastings. So that's like one of the big reasons it caught on, was this parallelizability. And it's, you know, trivial parallelizability that you don't have to work for in any way, because you can just, you know, it can just, the software can just call your probability function in parallel many cores at once. So yeah, that, those are kind of the two big reasons that it became really popular. And, you know, a decent implementation and documentation and stuff like that. There's always practical things involved in these things too. MC is in Python, so I haven't actually exactly figured out the landscape of Julia packages that implement the same thing. Seem to be a lot of options. Brendan Brewer's a New Zealand astronomer, I believe. Doesn't normally have a mustache, but, you know, apparently. MC is great, but not always the right choice. This is, you know, again, the question you had, what happens with multimodal distribution densities? What you can get in that situation is some of the walkers in one, on one hill and some of the walkers on the other. And then if they choose between the hills for their, as their helper, and the proposal distribution has a lot of proposals that suggest jumping into the valley between them or overshooting. So it's pretty unlikely to be able to accept a move like that. Because it's sort of like, you know, if you're looking from the top of one peak over to another peak and saying, where along that line can I step that's good? There's not really very many choices that are good. So it becomes really inefficient to try to sample that. If you sample within your peak, it works fine. But it's pretty difficult to move points between the peaks, which means that they don't have the, it tends not to get the balance between them correct. So if there's one, you know, if one peak is tall and the other is shorter, the ratio of walkers that are in either one won't in general be correct. It'll be some, you know, stochastic draw, and it's difficult to move between them. So that kind of gets baked in. So yeah, multimodal density distributions just don't work very well. In this is another one of Dan's like must be some sort of 2013 meme. I couldn't find it as an actual meme, but Bombcat. That means disaster of some kind or like problem. I think, I don't know, again, it's a millennial thing. In his slides, there's a bunch of Bombcats of things if you try to do something that's not gonna work very well. Bombcat! He's a character, if you ever get a chance to see Dan Forman Mackey give a talk. Okay, good. So that's all I had to say about affine invariant samplers, or MC in particular. Any questions about that before I move on to another topic? I know it's a bit of a whirlwind, but we'll come back and touch it in the lab tomorrow, and you can get a little experience with hopefully the lack of pain of that kind of sampler compared to Metropolis Hastings. Okay.
I have actually a quick question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, I mean, this question could be related to all different sort of algorithms that we are discussing. My question basically is that how large should be the relative difference? I mean, how steep should be my likelihood? If it's not changing or varying that much in portion of the parameter space, how these walkers or even a single walker is going to accept the or reject the true step? So what I mean is that if we have a real sort of, you know, data and the signal to noise ratio is very small, then it cannot understand. I mean, essentially, it's like that my likelihood is not as steep, or the peak is not big enough. So the relative difference from one step to the next is not. I was thinking, is there a criteria or is there a cutoff limit within the algorithm or within these codes that we can manipulate that to say, okay, if the relative difference even is as small as 10 to the minus 8, still consider that? Or is it cutting off something? Because I faced such a problem, that's why I always had this question. Maybe you're going to just mention it later, but yeah, I would appreciate if you could mention this.
Sure, good. Sure, thanks. So, yeah, I guess one. So, if you have a flat probability space, then there's sort of nothing stopping the ensemble of walkers from spreading out. You know, if there's no gradient, then they will basically just diffuse, because you know they'll choose a random one. There's sort of nothing stopping them from expanding outwards. On average, I mean, they can sort of expand outward or not, and they're sort of, you know, they can kind of just diffuse. It doesn't really, there's nothing sort of holding them in one place. If there's nothing very much happening, like if there's really no high peaks in the probability space, then say because there's the signal just isn't very strong in the data, then they will just tend to like roam around the space, spending a little bit more time on the peak. And you know, in general get the right answer, but it isn't very satisfying.
So even if there is a peak, but it's very small. I mean, the majority of the parameter space is almost flat. Then we have a very tiny peak at the very, very narrow circle or sphere in three dimension, a very narrowed region with a very small amplitude, for example, and that peak is there. But is there a way to control to, because I was feeling that, okay, these walkers are jumping above the peak, and as you mentioned, sometimes they are spending more time around there, but still they are getting diffused, and you can see that they are just walking around the parameter space and very free and happy.
Yeah. I mean, so the acceptance rule is like in Metropolis Hastings, where they always go uphill and sometimes go downhill. So even if there's like, you know, just a very small peak, then they will, you know, sort of tend to walk up it.
Mm-hmm.
And then commonly jump away from it and then tend to walk up it again.
Yeah. So there is no exact limit or criteria for that.
Not really. There's
you have to do kind of trial and error to see how it's going. And then if it's not good enough, then you change stuff.
Well, I mean, the thing is, in that case where there's like only a little hill, then like the right answer is for them to spend most of their time just exploring and like a little bit more time than usual on the top of the hill. But you know, because their goal is to draw samples from the distribution. It's not really to find the peak of the distribution. If your goal is to find the peak, then throwing it into an optimizer is like a way better bet. But if you know, if the goal is to draw samples from it, then this routine is the way to go.
Oh, I see. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. Okay, so timing's gonna be, we'll finish a little early, if you could. Another alternative to MCMC and MC is this set of algorithms called nested sampling. And they were originally built for a different task that you want to do in Bayesian inference, in particular, comparing models. So if you're trying to compare a linear model versus a quadratic model. The MCMC samplings we get don't actually let you do that in a really easy way. Nested sampling was sort of originally built to improve inference of that. But basically the idea is you kind of think, or at least the way I've been thinking about it is kind of have an idea of, you have your landscape and then slowly filling it with water and having the walkers try to stay on dry land. So the way what you do is it also has like an ensemble of points. They're just called live points in nested sampling. And the idea is you, at each iteration, you find the one at the lowest probability level and then try to draw from the entire space that's above water a new sample. Like, so try to find any place above water and then discard the one that has just dropped below the water level. And then find the next lowest one, move the water level up to there, and then say, find a place that's dry. Yeah.
So it means you ignore the height of the land above the water, which is looking for land?
Yeah, that's right. You ignore the height above the water. It's just, you're just looking for anything that's dry. And then it successively increases the water level and drops the lowest point, increases the water level, and then that basically, if there's multimodal distributions, it's no problem. At the end you have this, you know, you've placed a bunch of points at different heights of the distribution as you sort of have moved all of your points up as the water level goes up.
When you say it resamples, so I'm just saying, okay. So say you have 100 points, them are above, you know, okay, you drop one, and then when you resample.
You've seen right through my like easy description of the algorithm. The hard part is finding a place that's dry in this space that you don't really know anything about. Especially as the water level goes up, the amount of space that's dry, like the amount of land that's dry, is getting smaller and smaller. So how do you find, like, how do you draw a sample from that space? Is like the central challenge and the main like kind of heuristic thing required. Like main kind of cleverness involved is trying to do that efficiently. Because, you know, one thing you could do is just draw randomly from the entire space. But as the contours move up, that gets harder and harder to do if you just do it randomly. What they usually end up doing is using some sort of heuristic that near in the parameter space, near dry points is also likely to be dry. So it will do some sort of like sampling around the existing live points.
What if there's like a sharp peak somewhere and none of the points have kind of gone to that peak, and there's a smaller peak over here? You know, like how would you?
Yeah, you can still miss them. You can still miss peaks.
Are there any sampling methods that are robust to like multiple?
Not that I really know of. That's like the global optimization problem. It's hard. You know, you would say, if you're just given like a black box optimizer, like, you know, you just have a likelihood, a probability function that defines the space, like, it might be that like, oh, if you choose the magic numbers of 37.4 and 12.37, then the probability is amazing, and otherwise it's not.
Yeah.
You know, it's just,
like MC to find all the peaks, and then other ones to see a more accurate distribution on those peaks.
Yeah, you could. I mean, for that matter, you could run, you know, like in the lab, you could run an initial Markov chain Monte Carlo to explore the space, and then use that to define a proposal distribution. You know, you could run it once to get a good proposal ellipse, and then use that to really spend all of the effort, like to really sample it and come up with the final answer. So yeah, you can definitely, you know, use one of these tools to learn something about the space, and then use what you've learned to do some further exploration, for sure. There's no cheating, there's just learning. So there's another little example sort of thing showing that graphically. So I've kind of made when I've been showing examples, I've been showing you the contours. But it's kind of useful to remember that like the algorithm doesn't know what the contours are, right? The algorithm just knows, like, if I run the function with these parameters, it gives me back a probability level. And if I, you know, so it doesn't really know anything about the space until it asks. Okay, so these are 5 points that are currently above, well, there's no water yet. So they're all currently above water. You find the one with the lowest level and fill the water up to that level, and then say, find me a new point that's dry. I mean, we still don't know what that contour is. You know, we only know what that point is the lowest one. And then the algorithm has to find a point that's within, remove that point, and then somehow randomly find a point that's above, that's dry, that's above that contour. So, you know, and then basically as you increase the water level, you have to, you know, successively draw samples that happen to be in these smaller and smaller regions. And if it happens to have multi-peaks, then it's kind of fine.
Why would that be fine?
Pardon?
Why would that be fine?
Well, it's, it works. Like, you the algorithm's able to deal with it. The tricky part is this heuristic here, basically, or like the entire way along. You have this challenge of you have to draw a sample that's above the water level. And basically, you need some heuristic to use, or some constraint or something that says, how can I do that without having to explore the entire space? And usually that's done by assuming that you can draw some like ellipse or shape around the existing points with like a buffer around them, and that any place within that region will be dry.
How do you find the contour shape?
It isn't, like, it, you know, the algorithm doesn't know and doesn't try to find the contour shape. That's just getting, has just been like drawn on as a convenience for us to understand what's going on.
Okay.
So yeah, so it's maybe not a good demo.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, go.
Someone was asking questions there, that's why I stopped.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so there is no unique, is it unique way of how is filling, rising the water level, as you mentioned? I mean, like these contours that we are seeing, they're not unique, right? I mean, it could consider another point. So in the next step of the slide, for example, it is considering the middle point, but I was thinking why it's not choosing the right.
Oh yeah. So at each point, it's choosing the point with the lowest probability,
mm-hmm.
and then moving the water level up to that point.
Okay.
So yeah. Sorry, Batya. Did you have a question too?
Yeah, I was wondering. It's not for finding the contour so much, but it's for finding the maximum. Is that what it's?
It's for sampling at all levels of the distribution.
Okay, so you kind of do get, you don't get contours, but you get like, okay, this height here, this height somewhere here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A sample of height. Okay.
Right. And you know, in this, with only 5, it goes pretty slowly. Like, you don't draw that many samples. But if you have like 1,000 live walker or 1,000 live points, then you kind of you move the level up very slowly, so you draw a lot of samples from all over. And then so these algorithms usually have some sort of heuristic where it says, "Oh, I have these 5 live points. I'm going to make an estimate of what the shape of this contour is, usually with some ellipsoid or something, and then draw the new sample from that estimate or heuristic of what the shape is going to be." And then there's a challenge of like discovering or figuring out that it's split into 2. Like, oh, instead of, because you could draw an ellipsoid around both of those, and then you'd spend a lot of time sampling points from the middle that aren't going to work. So there's then has to be some other heuristic that's like, oh, I think it's split in 2. It is, I don't actually have a lot of experience running these algorithms, but they seem to definitely all have this kind of strong heuristic flavor of like.
Are you going to give us some examples of algorithms to do that?
Not really. I have a picture. So there's a few like kind of really popular implementations. Multinest is one of them. Polycord is another. And like, you know, at least in their demo pictures, they make this, they call this one the egg carton. You know, because it's like a so that kind of probability space. The algorithm apparently has no trouble with, you know, given proper given heuristics about how to find how many islands there are as you do it. It seems to kind of have no problem. Same with like these weird spaces. You know, imagine trying to, because these are hollow in the middle. So like imagine trying to sample that with Markov chain Monte Carlo. And let's see, I think I just have a couple more example pictures. These are, you know, from their marketing brochures, basically, or tutorial pictures. But so this is one called, I didn't give proper credit for this. This is Josh Spiegel, who is at Toronto, who has this another Python package called Dynasty. For dynamic nested sampling, and it has like a bunch of these sort of heuristics you can use. Like you can use single ellipsoids or multi ellipsoids or cubes or different things that try to kind of isolate basically the regions of the parameter space that are dry. And there's a at the end of there's a couple of links to one of them is the logo for Dynasty is an actual run of Dynasty on a picture, on like the picture of them, and you can see it sort of like sampling and like moving up the water level, drawing samples from them.
A little bit different sample every time, or
it's I guess it's not removing the samples from, like, it's not removing the dead points, I guess. Oh, no, this is probably showing, not showing the live points, only showing the dead points, because it's, right, because it hasn't drawn any samples in the middle, but it's only showing you the ones that have just gone underwater. And it sounds, the funny thing is at the end, like once the algorithm is done, the samples you want to keep are actually the ones you rejected. They're like the dead points, because they mapped out what the water level was. Anyway, I thought that was fun. And then there's also the other link is, oops, not that one. Oh, no. Sorry, I lost my, where's my, oh, it's full screen, probably on another. This web page also has a bunch of simulations of different samplers. This one is some sort of Hamiltonian Monte Carlo. The web page is cool, except it loads up. It really, it's like the developer has like an enormous screen, so it like loads up in a weird way, and the controls are tiny. So if we do, this is a nested sampling one. It keeps. Here it's trying to sample from this like sad face one, and the, how is it doing? Oh, it looks weird. But the greens are, the green ball is some estimate of what part of the landscape is above the current water level. And then as it rises, those estimates get sort of smaller and shrink and do what you'd sort of hope it would do, and sort of concentrate into the top of the sad face.
So what? There are some, at each step two, a pair of dots are getting connected. Is that any serious thing that's happening?
To be honest, I'm not exactly sure what that is indicating in this, in this animation. I think it might be sorry, I'm not exactly sure. I just found this yesterday and haven't explored it that much.
One thing that I missed, though, the initial samples, where how they're being produced, the initial dust that then they're removing those here.
Yeah, the initial samples for this are drawn from the prior distribution. So they would just, you know, usually be drawn, you know, randomly from the range of available parameters.
Okay.
How many points, initial points do you choose? Is that
how many you choose is just a settable parameter, and it determines how long, like how finely it samples the space. Because if you have a lot of points, then the gradation between, like, the difference in their heights will be small, so you'll spend more time.
Is it also possible to, like, Metropolis, assume a uniform distribution and just pick points randomly from the whole space?
Yeah, you could, but it just gets expensive as you get into the peaks of the distribution. All right, that's all I had to tell you about. So I'll take further questions, or we can call it a day.
If no one has any question, can I ask? If no one else in the class has questions.
Sure, go ahead.
Too much questions.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, it's fine.
Thank you. So I was, I had a question about the MC, the number of walkers.
Yeah, good.
How many number of walkers? I mean, if I increase that by too much, I'm feeling that there should be a cost. I mean, it's not that I can have 200 walkers and then say, oh, it's better than I can have, or reach the convergence limit faster, or span the entire parameter space faster or more efficient. So I was thinking maybe there is a limit or a range
to
have that number of walkers for each problem. How can we find that?
Yeah, good question. Okay, so how many walkers to use is like one of the frequently asked questions in the MC world. So one thing is there is definitely there's a limit that it has to be considerably larger than the dimensionality of the problem, because they're only drawing samples along lines between them. So that means that there's a finite subspace that they can access, right? If you have, if you only had three walkers in a three-dimensional space, then they can only sample on the hyperplane, on the plane rather, that spans them. And so if you have too few walkers, then there's a null space in the state space that you can just never reach. So that's a strict lower bound on how many walkers you need. But then beyond that, usually, as long as you're kind of a comfortable margin above that, it's pretty much okay. Usually you would, I mean, for one thing, it parallelizes and by the number of walkers divided by two. So if you have 40 cores in your machine like you do on Symmetry, then 80 walkers is a perfectly comfortable number. And it doesn't really cost you anything because in total, you know, wall time to solution, then 80 is as fast as 10. So, you know, that sort of drives from just a practical perspective, that can drive it. But yeah, it, as you make the number of walkers larger and larger, it's true that it will. I don't think it takes them longer in steps to burn in, but it takes them longer in time to burn in because you just every step takes longer.
I see. Thank you. And also, should they be a true an integer multiplication of dimension, number of dimension? I mean, if I have
four, no, it's not required. Walkers,
could they be like 21 walkers? Is that
so far as I know, there's no real reason to have any, you know, integer number of integer factor or anything like that.
Okay. So if you want to run an MCMC on a four parameter space and symmetry, and not the head node with 80 cores, I mean, then you would choose 80 walkers.
Yeah, I'd probably do something like that.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Oh, did you have one question, Eric? Yeah.
So in the movie that you showed earlier,
yeah,
regions around each dot that were the green square disks. And you said that's where the algorithm thinks it's above water. Now, the shape of these green regions.
Yeah.
And that reminds me of the original metropolitan algorithms.
Yeah.
You choose the steps in a particular region, so you choose a shape, and based on that, you do that. And now you have a new algorithm where the step sizes are choosing according to distribution. But at the second meta level, you're again introducing a particular shape in your space where you say, oh yeah, we're going to use disks for that. Because in principle, you could have used ellipsoids.
Yeah, that's true. So that's, and you're going to say, that's not affine invariant anymore. I thought you were selling us something affine invariant. yeah, I think that's true. I mean, sometimes they can, I'm pretty new to that space of algorithms, but I gather that some of them use the ensemble to define those ellipses, and some of them are like disks. So if you use an ensemble, then it helps you to be a affine invariant. But yeah, there does seem to be some like sensitivity to the shape of the space. And I don't really understand how they, because you, I think for it to sample correctly, you must have to have it be a strict upper bound, like a strict overestimate of the volume available to you. So I'm not exactly sure how that is like theoretically guaranteed.
That seems impossible because you know nothing about the space.
Uh-huh.
It will always be a small region in the far corner of the parameter space with a true global maximum size.
Yeah, I think that must be true. So I think it ultimately has to be heuristic.
Sure.
Driven by some some assumption you're willing to make about the parameter space. Okay. Good. Thank you.